Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And I think I've got a good one involving a teenager who is suspected of hitting a man, a 58-year-old man, in the back of the head with a skateboard. Now, I've heard people disparage this whole idea and say, well, it's just a skateboard. Have you ever picked up a modern skateboard today? It's a plank of wood. And it, depending on how hard you hit somebody in the head with it, I would imagine that somebody, maybe somebody who swings a baseball bat, you hit somebody in the back of the head with a skateboard, you might just kill them right then and there on the spot. Now, I'll give you the details that we know about, but I will tell you that one of the things that hamstrings both media and the public is the fact that these days, it doesn't matter how bad something is, if it was done by a juvenile in Oregon or Washington, you're not likely to learn their name, you're not likely to learn their fate, and that, I think, puts the community at risk. And I'm hearing from inside, in this case, of Gresham High School, that they are treating this case, to say the least, very, very inappropriately. Let me get into the details of that. And I also want to talk about a warning that's been made by the Northwest Power Planning Council. They say, hey, we're going to run out of electricity. Now, they say it in very bureaucratic terms, and they try to soften the blow. But while the states of Oregon and Washington, not Idaho, but Oregon and Washington, are pushing hard to get everybody to electrify your car, electrify your house, heat your house with electricity, heat your water with electricity, the folks who are in charge of making sure the region has enough power have already said the numbers don't add up. We're going to run short. And by the way, a big part of that is server farms. And we'll get into that, and I'll mention that as well. First, welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'm going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. By the way, if you happen to be a candidate, we're hearing from a lot of candidates, not very many Democrats. They don't seem to have much in the way of guts. But if a Democrat was running for office in Oregon or Washington, I would think one of the best things they could do is get on this show. Because if you don't know this already from listening to it, we have our fair share of progressive liberal Democrats like Paul from Woodinville and others. Paul just happens to be the most prominent one who will call the show all the time. They clearly listen all the time. So if you're running for office and you really want to reach the biggest audience in the Pacific Northwest, it's right here. And we're glad to have you buy commercials, but I give it away for free. So you want to call in, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And by the way, our poll on X today, Donald Trump has just thrown down the gauntlet. We'll talk about it a bit later on. But he says it's time for crooked Joe Biden, the worst president in the history of the U.S., and I to debate. And Donald Trump has said anytime, anywhere. Now, I told you yesterday how Joe Biden's staff has actually gone to the point where they don't let the president take questions anymore. They write the questions out. They plant the questions with the reporters. The reporters, for some reason, have thrown journalistic ethics out the window and said, I will ask the question the White House tells me to ask because it's written down in front of Joe. And then the White House staff writes the answer that Joe Biden is going to give. I mean, is that kind of artificial presidency right now? So I'd ask you this. Should Joe Biden take up President Trump's challenge today to debate? I don't mean debate him today, but should he say, yeah, I'm willing to debate Donald Trump? Or should he stay in the basement of the White House and try to win the way he won the last time around, or sort of won, appeared to win? You can find today's poll on X. Should Joe Biden take up President Trump's challenge to debate? You can find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, you probably heard the story on Sunday night, about 5:30. It was still daylight. A 58-year-old man by the name of Terry Poulter was simply at the corner of Northeast 2nd and Roberts in Gresham. And a young man comes up behind him. This is all caught on video, and slams him in the back of the head with a skateboard for no apparent reason. Now, thank goodness Terry Poulter, we're told, had non-life-threatening injuries. I imagine he was still injured, but they won't give other details. He has non-life-threatening injuries, but the police have video of the attack caught on camera. So what happened 2 days ago on Tuesday? A teenager has turned himself in to the police Tuesday night, and he says, I'm the one who hit the man in the head with the skateboard. They will only identify him as a 15-year-old, and as of Tuesday night, he was still in custody at the Donna Long home. Well, guess what's happened? And I'm glad for people who alert me this way. And again, I'll call the schools. They're not going to call me back, but we'll go through the due diligence process of actually asking Gresham schools. But this is what I'm hearing from a teacher on the inside that we've been tipped by before. You previously covered a story about a Gresham High School student taking inappropriate pictures of a child in the school's daycare and still being allowed to remain in school. Gresham's administration continues to put the safety of its students, staff, and community on the back burner, as evidenced today by letting a student who, and what this emailer, I won't even say the gender, says, who almost killed a man, letting him back into school without any type of reentry plan. Now, you say, well, Lars, you should check that. Well, if I waited till the schools called me back, you wouldn't be hearing about any of this. So the rest of the email says, I've copied the original story below. Gresham High teachers were informed yesterday by email that this student, the student who turned himself into the police on Tuesday night and said, I'm the guy who hit 58-year-old Terry Poulter in the back of the head with a skateboard for no reason, that this student would be allowed back only after a reentry meeting was held with counselors, administration, and the parent guardian. He was allowed back in without that meeting. When he showed up in class this morning, now this is why I'm telling you about this, I would ask you, if you've got a teenager who turned himself into the police, you say, well, that's the right thing to do. I'd agree with you. I'd also say that because they caught his face and his image on video, I imagine this kid turned himself in Tuesday night because he said, they've got video of me hitting this man. It's only a matter of time before the police catch up to me. He might have even talked to his parents about it. Good for him. But should he have been allowed to come back to school at all? And does that decision by Gresham High administration put your kids at risk? And if the teachers were told, we're not letting this kid back into class until we've sat down and had a meeting and figured out exactly what the rules are going to be and whether or not we're going to protect all the other students and maybe even the staff. You have, if his admission is correct, the young man who clobbered a 58-year-old man in the back of the head with a skateboard, and the emailer is right. If he had hit him hard enough, he might have killed him right then and there where he stood. He's back in school, and Gresham High has some explaining to do. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up, the Northwest Nonsense, right here on the Radio Northwest Network.
Because you like what you hear. Right, Lars Larson?
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
How about we assume that politicians are just congenital liars? That assumption goes double for feckless Ted Wheeler, the failed lame duck mayor of Portlandia. Voters chose this goofball 7 years ago, back when the city's homicide rate was less than a quarter of what it is today. And Portland had a beautiful, prosperous downtown. Now, today, not so much. Wheeler got a city-issued cell phone, and he immediately installed an encryption app on that cell phone. He made his text messages secret, despite signing his name to a promise not to use encryption because it makes public record text messages disappear. And then a citizen filed a records request for all the text messages on Wheeler's phone during the summer riots of 2020. 6,400 text messages over a two-year period simply disappeared from the phone. Wheeler's lies and cheating and violation of public records laws eventually cost the city of Portland an out-of-court settlement of $166,000. Politicians lie regularly, and some of them even take steps to hide what they're doing. Ted Wheeler can't leave City Hall soon enough for me. Our question of the day: how many other people are going to take advantage of situations like this? We told you that earlier this week, a judge in Cowlitz County decided that Washington State's ban on so-called high-capacity gun magazines violated both the state and federal constitution. Well, that got overruled about 88 minutes later. But in the meantime, a store in Washington State sold hundreds and hundreds of high-capacity ammo magazines in that short time period, less than 90 minutes between the judge ruling the ban unconstitutional and the state actually having the Supreme Court commissioner decide that it was constitutional after all. Now, it didn't make any sense. The decision, so-called, by the Washington State Supreme Court was not even made by the Supreme Court. It was made by an unelected commissioner, but the Supreme Court got what it wanted. And fortunately, a lot of Washington State residents got to buy the high-capacity magazines that they wanted. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the so-called Housing Justice Project. And if you say, what's that? Well, it's something that $4 million taxpayer dollars go to. It's run by the King County Bar Association, which sounds like it's about as liberal as possible. It's the association that represents lawyers in the city of Seattle and licenses them and the rest of that. Well, the Housing Justice Project is one of their little, their projects, and it's funded with taxpayer money. And I'll give credit to Cairo TV. They did a story about a man by the name of Jason Roth, and we've actually followed on the story at the same time that Seattle media has. Jason Roth owns a house, only he rented a house to a man who then stopped paying rent. But the man in the house just stayed. He refused to leave. So Jason Roth, the owner of the home, was left living in his van outside of his own house for about 10 months. Well, he finally managed to pry that renter loose. It took about 10 months. It cost him about $80,000 in back rent and legal fees. But finally, he's back in the house. But get this, the Housing Justice Project negotiated the eviction of this man, and it came with an agreement that they would take all record of the eviction off the renter, so-called renter squatter, the squatter's record. So in other words, the lawyers, funded with your tax money, are helping squatters stay in houses, and then when they finally get the boot, they take that off their record. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Tom Fellows writes in, Lars, ODOT recently had an opening for a Region 4 manager. Region 4 runs the entire length of the state, from the Columbia River to the border south of Klamath Falls. There are 5 ODOT regions. This is one of the larger ones. Last Friday, I had a conversation with one of the interviewers of the prospective candidates. Imagine that, running an entire ODOT region. And that person shared with me the fact that they got an email from ODOT announcing They were offering the position to the only candidate in the pool that did not have any background or knowledge of transportation at all. In fact, the person they announced they would offer the job to comes from the corporate world and has a background in diversity, equity, and inclusion. The interviewer shared that the lack of transportation knowledge was so poor, it was sad. They actually felt bad for that candidate, but it sounds like she got the job. What is ODOT thinking? Transportation is part of their name. Wouldn't you think they could find somebody who at least knows which end of the shovel is the working end and what it takes to patch a pothole? Thanks for your time, signed Tom Fellows. Well, I've reached out to ODOT in the last couple of weeks on this very issue. ODOT isn't giving me any kind of explanation as to why they would pass over better qualified candidates and choose somebody with no particular background in transportation at all, but that's the way your state agencies are being run. Keep those tips and information coming, would you? Talk at LarsLarson.com. To the phones now, and Michael Cross, who's running for Oregon State Attorney General. How are you doing, Michael?
Great, Lars. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. Now, I'm curious about something. Are you the same Michael Cross who ran for this office as a Democrat 4 years ago?
Absolutely not. I had the Republican nomination 4 years ago.
Good.
And our campaign did quite well in Multnomah County.
Good. I'm glad to hear that because I wanted to correct some bad information out there. So tell people who are listening why you should be the next Attorney General of the state of Oregon.
Well, with my former military background and, you know, I've worked for myself most of my life, nonsense approach to, you know, this kind of stuff. And we need to get our state back, Lars. And you know, I take a real dim view with these politicians that even in the AG's role, they don't seem to understand that while they defend and prosecute cases on behalf of the state, they seem to think that, and in fact, Ellen Rosenblum said exactly these words, that she is the governor's lawyer. And, you know, then why would we, the people, go and vote for this position? No, it's part of the checks and balances in our governance that our founding fathers wisely put in, which I clearly understand. And, I think that if you're a person having a problem with the department or an employee of the state, the AG's office should be your first call because that's what we're there for. And we're elected by the people and we serve the people.
Where can people find out more about your candidacy? Because after all, the primary is coming right up.
Yeah, absolutely. It's MichaelCross4Oregon.com. And the four is a number four. So MichaelCross4Oregon4.com.
Boy, there are a lot of issues you could take on. I mean, we've got corruption in Val Hoyle, member of Congress, former Boley commissioner. We've got corruption in Shamia Fagan, who just managed to quit her job and avoid any kind of prosecution. We've got corruption in the Democrat Party taking money from FTX. They returned the money, but they only returned it after a lot of pressure and a lot of months went by.
Yep.
There seems to be enough corruption in Salem. You could spend all your time in Marion County and never get outside of there.
Well, sir, I think we're going to have to hire some special prosecutors because you know what? No one, absolutely nobody, I don't care who they are, is above the law.
Absolutely right. That's Michael Cross. He's running for Attorney General in the state of Oregon as the Republican candidate. The primary election, of course, coming up in May, but the ballots go out before then. You're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Simply by listening, you're proving how smart you really are. Lars thanks you.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and what we like to call Conspiracy Theory Thursday. We'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, including all those great tips from inside the agencies that won't tell us the time of day. I'd love to get more of those tips. Pete Serrano joins me now, who's director and general counsel for the Silent Majority Foundation and a candidate to replace Bob Ferguson as attorney general in Washington State. Pete, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Lars.
Now, I'm not a lawyer like you are, but I've done my best to tell my audience about the craziness that happened this week, where a Cowlitz County judge hears an entire case and decides Washington State's high capacity magazine ban, which I have a buy, I have a dog in the fight because I own some high capacity magazines, all bought before, you know, the legislature went crazy and made them illegal. So mine are all legal. But the lower court judge hears the entire case, writes up a decision, says they're unconstitutional both on the state and federal constitutions. And then all of 88 minutes go by before a court commissioner, not the justices on the Washington Supreme Court, decide, no, it's constitutional enough, and they leave it in place. I want you to comment on all of that, and then I may have some more specific questions, but be sure to share with my audience where they can find your website and social media for your campaign to be AG.
Perfect. We'll start there. So my website for the campaign for Attorney General is Serrano, S-E-R-R-A-N-O, 4AG.com, all spelled out. So S-E-R-R-A-N-O-F-O-R-A-G.com. And certainly for Silent Majority Foundation is silentmajorityfoundation.org. So circling back to what's happened in the past couple days, on Monday evening at about 3:15, I get an email that says, it's a decision from the Calhoun County Superior Court, and I read it and says, the high capacity magazine, as they call it, is enjoined. And as you mentioned, this is critical, Lars, under both the state and federal constitution, Judge Gary Vasher deemed this to be unconstitutional. And so the state within 5 minutes sends an email to the state Supreme Court and says, hey, we are going to ask for a stay on the injunction. And what we think about probably for the best way to explain this to the listeners is, If you have a light switch, the law's on once it passes the chambers and it's signed in by the governor, and then an injunction turns that switch off. So it says pause, no enforcement. Now, a stay on an injunction basically flips the light switch back on. So a 55-page opinion by this Calhoun County Superior Court judge is then supposedly read and deemed worthy of a stay by this Supreme Court commissioner within 88 minutes, which is pretty shocking to me, because quite frankly, as one who's litigated the issue, one of the two attorneys involved in this on behalf of Gators Guns, you know, I'm still digesting some of the nuances of this opinion.
Interrupt for a moment and let me ask you a question. Ken, I understand the state Supreme Courts in both Oregon and Washington, in theory, they're elected, really, they're appointed in, for the most part in Oregon, and then they just get reelected, and that's a whole complicated process, but all the justices are appointed, so the public doesn't even really get a say, except about reelecting the ones that are already there. So, but can a court commissioner, an appointed bureaucrat, make a decision on behalf of the state Supreme Court?
So he has the authority to act fundamentally as a gatekeeper. And so what he did here was he stayed it, which I think, you know, basically that's the top of his threshold. He didn't totally undo the analysis. He didn't say that the judge has this wrong. He just said, in, again, mind you, he's looking at a 55-page opinion and about a page and a half, if that, says, well, I think there's a public safety concern here. Therefore, I'm going to stay the injunction. And then we have to brief this. Our brief due tomorrow, and then the state's brief is due Tuesday, and then Wednesday at 3:30 p.m. And this will be available on TVW for anyone out there that wants to watch the arguments. That's the website or the live stream that the court uses, the legislature uses. So TVW, our arguments at 3:30 on Wednesday. So for folks wanting to watch and see what happens, we will be in front of that commissioner. Only on the question of whether or not the injunction should be stayed. Simultaneously, the state's already filed an appeal of the injunction, which will go before the actual justices. That's probably going to take a few weeks to a month to get that. I'm sure they're going to try to seek emergency. I will tell you this. Oregon's Measure 114, the state Supreme Court down there decided not to entertain that. Those emergency motions, you know, they let it go through the full hearing all the way for about a year, year and a quarter in the Harney County.
Yep.
You guys call it the district court, not the superior court. And so they let it go full gamut. So there's a possibility. I'm not going to hold my breath, but there's a possibility that the Washington State Supreme Court could say, hey, you know, we're going to dissolve the stay and you guys can fight this out or we'll uphold the stay.
I just don't understand how an appointed person who's not elected, can make a decision on behalf or, in effect, acting as the entire Supreme Court. How is that possible?
Yeah, you know, the unfortunate part of that position is, you know, and all of our appellate courts have commissioners, whether it's the division, the two, three divisions of the courts of appeal or the Supreme Court. And typically, again, they work as gatekeepers. It's the notion, and I'm not saying I agree with it, is that they're hired by the court itself to take these kind of lower level issues and venue jurisdiction. But to your point, why is it that this single person is issuing a stay on a fundamental right?
Yeah, and
how is
the second,
that a quote unquote lower level?
It doesn't make sense. The other legal question I want to know, if the Cowlitz County Court properly said it's unconstitutional by the state constitution and it's unconstitutional under the federal constitution, can the Washington State Supreme Court even overrule a finding that something violates the federal constitution?
Well, that's going to be what's really interesting about this. And that's why we pled both the state and the federal constitutional principles at the, like in our early pleadings on this matter. And I'm so grateful that Judge Basher actually addressed those. And for anyone that's read the opinion, you'll know that he addressed them simultaneously, but separately, right? And so what we have is this opinion where the question that I'm looking at is the Supreme Court going to even entertain the Second Amendment analysis? If it does, and it takes a different standpoint, that gives us the right to look at appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, because now they're, you know, opining on federal constitutional principles. If they stay in the lane of just Article 1, Section 24 of the Washington Constitution, now it still leaves it enjoined under the federal constitution, but they may have their own opinion of what Judge Basher did being correct or incorrect. So there's going to be a lot of moving parts at play over the next handful of months. Again, I think this will stay fast tracked, not just the stay, but the actual analysis on the constitutionality of the law. I mean, it's from a lawyer's standpoint, this is such an intriguing thing because we have the federal and the state constitution at play. The Supreme Court may step into an area where it starts to jump in on the federal constitution. Now all of a sudden you
can
have
they do
Supreme
that?
Court issues.
Can they do that?
Well, they can, but then again, what it does is it opens the door to immediate appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now we don't have to go to the Ninth Circuit. We don't have to push it to a district court. We can take.
They may open that door up for you. That's great.
Well, you know, it's a political question, right? They could. Let's put it this way. They have the ability to do so, or they can just analyze it under the state constitution and say, you know what? Sorry, it's still enjoined because of the Second Amendment. Then the state of Washington has the decision of what it wants to do from an appellate standpoint.
You got to check out his website. It's Serrano, S-E-R-R-A-N-O, Serrano, F-O-R-A-G, Attorney General. Pete, thanks very much. Back in a moment, I got to get to that power question. Power planners in the Northwest say we're running out of juice. Kilowatts. We'll get to that in your call.
Just think of him as your concealed carry. This is the Lars Larson Show.
This portion of our show is brought to you by the O.J. Simpson Limousine Service. We get you to the airport with time to kill. That knife, a stiletto with a stag handle right there. The one used by O.J. for that double murder. O.J. didn't pay. That jury, they set him free. It was an outrage and a travesty.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's Jim Gossett doing a little ode to the now late O.J. Simpson, who died. Yesterday he died. His family announced his death today. He was 76 years old, and as far as I'm concerned, he killed his ex-wife. And you say, well, how can you say that? The jury found him not guilty of murder. I would point out there were two trials. There was the criminal trial at which you're right. The jury, which a lot of lawyers said engaged in jury nullification. a complicated idea, but the idea that they didn't like the fact that O.J. Simpson had been accused of killing his ex-wife, so they found him not guilty. And then there was the civil trial, which even producer Joel points out, and he's right, civil trials are based on preponderance of the evidence. Different, very different from beyond a reasonable doubt. But the civil trial, and I covered that one as well, a civil trial determined that he was legally responsible for Nicole Brown Simpson's death and awarded $25 million to her family, money that the family has been spending decades trying to get out of O.J. Simpson. He moved to Florida, which used the tax laws and the property laws of the state of Florida to avoid having to pay the family anything. And, of course, we were told by O.J. Simpson that he was going to spend the rest of his life searching for the true killer of Nicole Brown Simpson. And apparently, before he died yesterday, O.J. Simpson had searched virtually every golf course in America looking for the true killers of Nicole Brown Simpson. I have a feeling he's not going to be going anywhere pleasant after his demise yesterday. But there you have that. That's my opinion on O.J. Simpson. Today's poll on X, should Joe Biden take up President Trump's challenge to debate? I would say yes. I'd be glad to take a naysayer who thinks the answer should be no. But you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I decided to talk about that Gresham case involving the young man, a teenager, 15 years old, who turned himself in Tuesday night, admitted that he was the one who hit a 58-year-old man in the back of the head with a skateboard for no apparent reason. I think that was a worthy thing to do, although the fact that he got caught on video doing the deed probably meant that he looked at the video and he thought, it's only a matter of time till they catch up with me. But I got a complaint from somebody inside Gresham High School who says he's back. Nobody from Gresham High is willing to go on the record, but my producer, Donovan Sargent, reached out to them. We do our due diligence, and they gave us the answer. He's not officially back in school yet. I don't know what they're doing, whether they're playing games. I'd be glad to talk to anybody from Gresham Schools. Is that kid back in school and back in class, as I'm told from inside the schools, and are they running a game on the public and not telling them what's going on? But I want to take a moment and mention a fairly major story, and I'll give credit to the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper, in this case, the Seattle Times. The state and its neighbors are going to face challenges keeping the lights on while complying with environmental mandates. A panel of experts told the Northwest Power and Conservation Council in its monthly meeting 2 days ago. Now, I think they've said it as softly as they can. The hard way to say it is, we're running out of electric power. We're going to be running critically short, and all of this while the Greens in the Northwest have decreed that we will shut down coal-fired power plants. They've already shut down Centralia. They've shut down Boardman. And there are 10 other plants that feed the states of Oregon and Washington from outside the region. And get ready for this. About 20% of Washington state's power comes from natural gas. And if your reaction to that is much like mine, and you say, well, natural gas, that's clean. That is clean. Well, it's cleaner than oil, but the Greens still hate it. Now, here's the key part from that story in the Seattle Times. The Northwest is going to need 4,000 megawatts of added generation. And they say that does not count the 1,600 megawatts of energy demand from more data centers that just popped up in the last several weeks. These are the ones like Facebook and Amazon and X, Twitter, and others. So in other words, the region is about 5,600 megawatts of power short. If they tear out the Snake River dams, that's going to leave us another 8% short. That's a big chunk of power that's gone, and they don't know how they're going to replace it, so get ready for it. It sounds like the power shortages, the brownouts, and the blackouts are coming. Let's go to Santiago, who's a naysayer. Hey, Santiago, we're close to the break. What do you and I disagree about today?
Well, actually, we always disagree. I don't know why. But anyways, as far as Joe Biden, you know, debating Trump, there's no way. Why give Trump a platform? I mean, he should debate it in the past, Nikki Haley, and all the Republican candidate, presidential candidate before, he never showed up because the poll, according to the poll, he was always like 30 points ahead of them.
But shouldn't Joe Biden have to answer any questions about his bad decisions over the last 4 years?
No, you know, I would have said yes if he would have debated, you know, those Republican presidential candidates.
But should Joe Biden have to answer questions, Santiago?
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You want a great conspiracy theory for Conspiracy Theory Thursday? Imagine you live in one of the major cities of the Pacific Northwest, and the folks tell you, the experts, so-called, tell you, you need to have water filtration. And you say, well, what do I need that for? And they say, well, because we've been drinking the same water for decades, and it's fine. They say, there's this thing called cryptosporidium. Well, have we ever had that problem? Well, no. Well, what are my possible solutions? Well, we can have a giant filtration plant, and this is 7 years ago. It's going to cost $350 to $500 million, half a billion bucks. So anywhere from a third to a half a billion dollars. And you say, well, are there any other possible solutions? And they say, yeah, we could just run all the water past ultraviolet light, and that would cost you maybe $100 million. So in other words, it's one-third the cost of the original proposal to as little as 20% of the cost. And you say, why don't we do it that way? No, we want to build this big filtration plant, but we're going to be able to bring it in somewhere between $350 million and $500 million. Now, if you take, and that was only 7 years ago. I know we've had some inflation since 7 years ago, especially because of Joe Biden. And then they come to you today and say, hey, by the way, the cost has gone up a bit. And I'm going to go to Angela Todd to talk about where it's gone and why it's gone and why this is still happening to us. Angela is, of course, from the group called PDX Real. They focus a lot of attention on people living on the streets, but also on issues like this. Angela, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. Okay, so 2017, as you mentioned, there was a maximum spend, kind of like for contingency, of $500 million. They are now at $2.3 billion for this filtration plant. That's 500% more. And yesterday, even with all testimony except for the public employees and the contractors that are going to get a windfall of money, every single private citizen was absolutely aghast at these water rates that are going to increase. And city council voted unanimously yesterday to move forward with this $2.3 billion budget that is expected to increase water bills for Portlanders 8.1% year after year after year for 10 years. And that won't even cover this loan yet. It is absolutely outrageous, and not enough people know about it.
And by the way, Angela, let me make it worse than that. Because Mingus Maps, this city commissioner who literally years ago said, Lars, I'd be glad to come on your show. And we have tried ever since to get him to actually fulfill that promise. But like most politicians, I just figure Mingus was probably lying. Because I'd love to ask him about it. He actually says, by the way, at $2.13 billion, not 2.3, but $2.13 billion, there's no guarantee it won't increase again. In fact, he leads you to believe it probably will increase. They may not even finish it for 4.5 times as much as they originally proposed. But then they try something kind of sneaky. Did you spot the sneaky way that they say, oh, this isn't going to affect rates at all? Do you know how they're going to do that?
Tell me.
Well, the chief engineer for the Water Bureau, Jody Inman, says there will be no additional impact on rates from these cost increases. And why is that? Because they plan to take out federal loans and they plan to defer a number of major infrastructure projects. And you say, well, what does that mean? What it means to me, Angela, is anytime the Water Bureau is building infrastructure other than the really fancy building headquarters that they build for themselves, we're talking about pipes and valves for the most part. It's getting water from point A to point B. So if they defer a major infrastructure project, it means whatever pipes and valves they were planning to build, they're not going to build them right now. And since I assume that any city water bureau doesn't say, hey, let's just build a bunch of pipes and valves that we don't actually need, that these are actually infrastructure projects that they need to do. Pipes and valves, either replacing old ones or putting new ones in to provide the service that's needed. They say, we'll just put that off for a few years. So it's like the guy who has a $500 breakdown in his car, and his friends say, well, you don't have much money. How are you going to pay for that? He goes, well, I'm just going to put off an infrastructure purchase. And they say, what's that? You say, well, I'm not going to buy new tires for my car. Well, does your car need new tires? Well, yeah, it sure does. I'm down to the threads right now. And they say, so you're going to pay for the car repair with money you were going to spend on something you actually need right now, and you're just going to put that off into future years. That just means we won't be paying for it today. We'll be paying for it in a year or 2 years or 5 years or 10 years, but the cost is still there. And if they had already planned to do these infrastructure projects, let's assume, Angela, do you think we can fairly assume that the only reason they build pipes to carry water is because they need the pipes to carry the water, or the old pipes need to be replaced?
Yeah, it's just an absolute mismanagement of money across the board. I'm getting my feet wet into this federal loan program, which I believe it's like WIFIA. That loan is only for $720 million, hardly the $2 billion that they need. I suspect, and maybe I'll get some flack for this, but sometimes my opinion comes true and sometimes it doesn't, and I'm willing to take the cred, but I believe they've gotten the money, and I believe that they've spent it. And
you think they've already spent it?
I do. I think that the reason that city council is not moving off of this vote, which they can do as long as the Oregon Health Authority and the Portland Water Bureau agree to move to the more affordable ultraviolet at Headwaters that would take care of the cryptosporidium.
For $100 million in 2017 dollars. So even if that had doubled, $200 million instead of $2 billion, I mean, how is that even a hard decision?
Yeah, it was, Lars, yesterday in the meeting, what really stuck out for me was that they were talking talking about how much diversity and contractors they have for this. There was a large portion of the meeting about that. And they had people come up and talk about how this legacy project is going to, you know, inform their business and help, you know, their particular family and their community. And I was like, what planet are we living in?
So they're going to have a bunch of gay and transgender engineers or pipe fitters or whatever they are. I don't care about that. What I care about is whether or not people get water. And the idea of spending $2 billion and no guarantee it won't increase in Mingus Maps as much as he's willing to talk to the Oregonian but not to us is saying expect it to increase from there.
Yeah, and let's talk about some of those reasons that we haven't talked about. You know, one of the things they keep saying is they're going to spread this out among a million different water users. That's not true. The three largest wholesale customers that Portland Water Bureau sells to are City of Gresham, the Rockwood Water Public Utility District, and Walden Valley Water District.
And they're just going to spread the cost out. Angela, keep tracking it. We'll keep on top of it as well. Can you think of any good reason why any city anywhere in the Northwest would spend $2 billion when they could get the job done for, say, $200 million? We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Brought to you by American Humane.
Saying
things you wish you could say. More with Lars.
For several months and really for years has tried to call anybody who believes that it came from the lab or looks at evidence that the virus came from this lab, calls them conspiracy theorists, downplays them, denigrates them. He promoted journal articles to downplay and say it wasn't possible when all the while it looks like he knew it, Peter Daszak knew it, Ralph Baric at UNC knew it.
At UNC. Now that's Rand Paul, member of Congress and a medical doctor. He's an ophthalmologist and a surgeon. And what he's talking about is the lab leak theory, except there's some brand new information that I want you to know about. And it shows that about a dozen federal agencies were trying to create a new kind of coronavirus before the pandemic happened. And you say, Lars, that's just conspiracy talk. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you as my source a medical doctor who happens to be a member of the United States Senate and has been one of the very few U.S. senators who's actually tracked this thing. And I know that there are people who don't like Rand Paul. I mean, heck, his neighbor even physically attacked him some time ago. But I don't think anybody would call him a crackpot or say he doesn't know what he's doing when it comes to medicine. Let me get into the details in a moment. First, welcome back to the Lawrence Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, even on this subject, I'd be glad to take your calls, and we'll put you right to the head of the list. You want to email? talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always answer our X poll question. Today's question, since Donald Trump has now thrown down the gauntlet, should Joe Biden take up President Trump's challenge to debate? I would answer yes to that. I've already heard from naysayers who say, no, there's no reason that Joe Biden should have to answer questions about all the bad decisions, the ones that have killed people, not just here, but overseas, but killed Americans, wiped out jobs, put our country in economic straits. Joe shouldn't have to answer those questions at all. And I would imagine I'll hear from some of those naysayers. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So if we're talking about the lab leak theory, and that's the one that goes all the way back to the beginnings of COVID in 2020. But really, COVID began in 2019. China knew that it had an epidemic on its hands. And I think my theory has always been, they created the virus in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They did it with research and knowledge they gained from having American taxpayers fund secret research at that Wuhan lab that had been declared off limits. That is, the president at the time, Barack Obama, had said this stuff, this gain of function stuff, this is too dangerous to do in the United States. So he forbade the NIH, National Institutes of Health, from funding any of that kind of research in the United States. He said, you can't do it. It's too dangerous. So what did Anthony Fauci and company do? They decided to do the research anyway, only they moved it to a safer location. They moved it to a laboratory that was notorious for making mistakes and having spills and accidents in a communist-controlled country called China. Now, we know that. And my theory has always been, since it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, that the Chinese had an accident. Their lab was known to have been sloppy about the work that they did, and the virus got out. Now, there are some people who think the Chinese set this loose deliberately. I'll tell you, the truth is somewhere halfway in between. I think the Chinese were doing military research at that lab. They were glad to have American taxpayers show them, pay for the work to show them how to make gain of function in viruses, meaning turning a virus that's not dangerous to humans into a virus that is dangerous to humans. And for the last 4 years, I've been asking everybody in the medical field, is there any good reason to do that? And not one of them has been able to say it really makes sense to create dangerous viruses out of benign viruses, because then we can figure out how to fight them. Well, how about this? Don't make the dangerous viruses dangerous to humans. But nobody seems to want to hear that. So what do we know now that's new today? John Solomon, who's one of the best investigative reporters in America, you find his work at justthenews.com. Here's the story that broke early this morning. More than a dozen federal agencies asked to fund the creation of a new kind of chimeric SARS-CoV-2 spike protein with highly infectious, what they call a furin cleavage site. It's one of the designs, genetic designs within the virus that makes it especially dangerous to humans. And when did they do this? When did these 15 federal agencies go to the government and say, we would like to do this kind of thing to create a novel, which means new, novel chimeric SARS-CoV-2 spike protein? Well, they did it 2 years before the pandemic. 2 years. So in other words, they were saying, we want to take the American taxpayers' money. We want to go out and do the kind of research that has been declared off limits by the federal government. Say you can't do that kind of research, and we want to figure out how to make new and more dangerous viruses. What does the story show? It shows the National Institutes of Health, three cabinet-level departments, multiple federal agencies who could have warned the public as early as 2018, 2 years before the pandemic, about the research planned by China's Wuhan Institute of Virology and a private enterprise called EcoHealth Alliance, the nonprofit that was the conduit for federal funding. The Rocky Mountain Laboratories, RML, part of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease, led by none other than Anthony Fauci for 40 years, was even listed as a partner in the Wuhan Institute for Virology project known as DFUSE. And DFUSE was being led by EcoHealth President Peter Daszak. And we've talked about Peter Daszak before. This is all according to the top Republican on the Senate Homeland Security Committee, the man you just heard a moment ago, and that was Kentucky's Rand Paul, who asked the 15 agency heads in separate letters that were sent out 2 days ago for more information. And he wants the information in the next 2 weeks about their knowledge and involvement in two projects. One is called DFUSE. The other one is called Preempt. Paul identified other listed partners, including the usual suspects, the University of North Carolina lab that was run by Ralph Baric, who collaborated directly with the Wuhan Institute. Baric said he discussed the outbreak and chimeras with Fauci in February of 2020. Another one is the Columbia University lab that's run by Ian Lipkin, who originally told Fauci, quote, there was a nightmare of circumstantial evidence tying the Wuhan Institute of Virology to SARS-CoV-2. They then put together a paper called the Proximal Origin Paper that dismissed the lab leak because Fauci and then NIH Director Francis Collins, they were involved in making them write this paper. Say we need something to tell the public so we can disabuse them of the notion that this virus came from a Chinese lab. My theory about it has always been that the Chinese had a lab. They were doing dangerous research. They had a leak. People got sick. We know that at least three people at Wuhan Institute for Virology got sick in the fall of 2019. The Chinese knew they had a problem, and they said, if we're going to get part of an epidemic, we're going to make sure the rest of the world gets it, too. And that was only shut down when President Trump said no more flights from China. And that didn't happen until the end of January. And by that time, well, the cat was already out of the bag. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Informed and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you're watching what goes on in the news and you're watching the politicians, you see Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, and other figures running around saying, no, the economy is going great, inflation is going down, prices are down, wages are up, things are rosy. And then you take a look at the actual numbers and you say, it doesn't look so rosy to me, but I'm not an economist. So I call somebody who is. Véronique Desrougis, who's a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Véronique, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
How bad is it right now? And then I'll ask you some stupid questions after that.
Well, I mean, it's bad. I mean, we have like, if you just filed your taxes, $2 out of every $10 you send to the IRS is going to pay interest on the debt. And that's only for the revenue that we actually have. Interest payment on the debt is going to be $1.1 trillion this year. And it's very unclear that interest rates are going to go down anytime soon. We don't have the money for it. And President Biden decided that it was the right moment to do another student loan forgiveness program.
So he's going to pump more money into an economy that's already inflated from the previous money
that pumped into
the economy.
Yes, and by the way, the CPI yesterday, right, it's like it rose by 0.4% in March, and this is like the third time in a row. And I actually think it has to do with these interest payments that are that we're piling on, and there's no talk of austerity. And I think investors would have a right to question whether eventually this money is going to be the way the Fed is going to deal with that problem is by letting inflation go. And I think that's what people are worried about.
And they really won't have much choice. Let me ask you something about that, because yesterday, Veronique, my audience is used to me carping about things, but usually I do it, try to say, hey, could we do this differently? All the media was reporting, well, over the last 12 months, inflation ran at 3.5%. which I keep reminding people is 75% higher than it was when Joe Biden took office, around 2. So it's much higher inflation that persists. But worse than that, like you said, the month of March was 0.4%. And, you know, forgive me if this isn't the right way to do it, but I always multiply those numbers by 12. And I say that's just short of 5% over the next 12 months. And the media keeps saying, no, no, no. What you should focus on is what's already happened. Over the last 12 months, it's been 3.5. And I said, but if it continues at this rate and doesn't get worse, it's going to be 5% inflation over the next 12 months. And frankly, Veronique, I care more about what inflation is coming at me than the inflation I've already seen. And I think most people would as well, wouldn't they?
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, and it's correct. I actually think that, I think the stock market and the market has been deranged by so many years with close to zero interest rates that they've completely lost track of what things should look like, and they just are not yet quite looking at what's happening. Those months that are like going up of inflation, 3 months in a row where inflation's going up, and they're like obsessed about when the next interest rates cut is going to be from the Fed, and they're just not looking at what's happening ahead. And I worry that this is the precursor of inflation, you know, rising again in part because of the spending, but also because the Federal Reserve is not raising rates anymore, and kept saying that it's going to actually cut rates when inflation is not taken care of. So I worry, and I worry. And,
well,
and this
tell me, look, we're Econ 101 students out here, Veronique. You know the stuff. But if I read you right, you expect the Fed will say, well, we have to pump up the economy. So they will not raise rates on money. They'll drop rates. That'll flush more money in. And we may think of 5% inflation as moderate compared to what we might be seeing later this year. Is that overstating it?
No, that's not overstating it. And just let me remind you what happened in the 70s. In the 70s, we had kind of a similar problem, which was that when inflation started going down and the economy started slowing down, then politicians put pressure on the Fed and first starting spending money to help with the slowdown of the economy and putting pressure on the Fed to lower interest rates. And what the inflation did was going back up. And it took a Volcker coming and telling basically the Reagan administration, I don't care if there's I'm exaggerating, but I don't care effectively if there's a big recession. Don't count on me to save your political butt. am going to do what it takes for the inflation to go away, and he raised the rate very, very high and stayed there no matter what happened in the economy. And we have none of that happening. The Federal Reserve was under a lot of pressure due to the interest rate increase, and he stopped raising, even though the inflation wasn't taken care of, and he hasn't raised, and he even announced that he was going to cut. The closer we get to the election, the more pressure is going to be on Chairman Powell to cut rates. If he does, I think inflation will go back up even more than we've seen in the last 3 months.
And if the rates go up, then that means all that federal debt that we're now paying $1.1 trillion in interest alone during the year, as that's going to raise the cost of the government borrowing money, and they have to keep rolling this debt over because a third of it is very short term, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the real problem, right, is like a third of our debt has to be rolled over every year. So basically, the pain of higher interest rates is felt immediately.
Except the administration's reaction to that has been, well, let's spend more money. And you say, but you don't have the money. And they say, well, we'll just borrow it. Well, you're paying we used to pay $400 or $500 billion a year in interest. I remember because it worked out to about, I think it was about $3 billion a day. And now we're paying $1.1 trillion a year in interest. Mm-hmm. That's an amazing, as you said, $2 out of every 10 you send to Uncle Sam is going just to pay the interest on the debt.
Yes.
At what point does it consume so much of the budget we can't run things anymore?
Well, so the real risk is less this, even though that's the risk. It's going to be crowding out some of the spending we want to do. The real risk, though, is that as we roll over that debt, investors at some point start saying, you know what, we're going to need even more interest rates for us to agree to lend you more money, especially short-term money, which we are almost sure is going to be paid back in deflated money, in deflated,
If somebody loans you $50,000 for a car, but they know they're going to get paid back 4 or 5 years from now with money that's worth a whole lot less than it is today, they're going to want a higher interest rate.
Exactly. So that's the real risk. Before we run out of revenue to pay for interest payments, I think the risk is that investors are going to start being worried and ask us for much higher interest payments. And then when they start, that could trigger a whole lot of problems for us.
And Joe Biden is just going to run around the country seeking votes and saying everything is fine, don't worry about it, like he was 3 years ago in the summer of 21 when he was saying, oh, it's temporary, it'll end, it's just transitional. That's Veronique DeRougie, who's a senior fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Back at home, we'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Here's Lars Larson. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls. By the way, this segment comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Now, I want to give you an update on something I began the show with today. I was talking about Gresham High School. Now, something's happened at Gresham High School, not dangerous right now, but I got a tip from a teacher. There was an incident on Sunday in which a 58-year-old man minding his own business, by all accounts, was hit in the back of the head by a kid with a skateboard. Now, this was captured on video. And Tuesday night, a young man, 15 years old, walked into the police and said he was the one who had hit the man in the head with the skateboard. Thankfully, we're told that the man had non-life-threatening injuries. He was taken to the hospital, and apparently he's going to be okay. But you can well imagine, if you've ever seen a modern skateboard, that if somebody clocked you in the back of the noggin hard enough with that skateboard, they could kill you. They could at least do some very serious damage. So this is a serious assault. And apparently the young man, 15-year-old, who did it, or says he did it, walked into the police, gave himself up. They have video of the incident, so he probably may have figured that, well, it's just a matter of time till they figure out who I am. Anyway, they'll go around the neighborhood, they'll go around the school and say, do you recognize this kid? And they were going to be at his doorstep. So he turned himself in on Tuesday night. That's a good thing. But then teachers were told at Gresham High School, where apparently this suspect in a violent crime was going to be brought back into school today. And he did go back to school today for a time. Now, here's what's happened. We did our due diligence. I reached out after I got the tip from the teacher, and I asked the school, is this kid in school? And they answered in a way that is technically accurate but deceptive, which doesn't surprise me at all the way schools are being run today. What they said was, he is not in school. What they didn't say was, he wasn't here earlier this morning, or he was here earlier this morning, until the teachers raised an objection and said to the administration, you promised us that this kid would not come back to school until there had been a meeting between the teachers, the administration, and a plan was laid out for how you bring somebody back into a school who's been accused and may in fact be guilty of a very serious assault. And what was said to me was, teachers were informed yesterday by email the student would only be allowed back in after a reentry meeting was held with counselors, administration, and the parent or guardian, and he was allowed back in this morning without that meeting. When he showed up in class this morning, the first period teacher and counselor were both scolded by the school administration for even asking if the meeting had happened. On behalf of all the teachers and students who are afraid for their safety every day at Gresham High, please consider this as a follow-up story. Well, I have. And when we call the schools, all they'll say is, he's not here, by which they mean, he's not here right now. He was here earlier today. Our own staff raised the objection, and he was removed from the school again. Now, do I think that a kid accused of that kind of assault, especially when there's video of the incident, and he's clearly dangerous to somebody? He was certainly dangerous to that 58-year-old man that he clocked in the back of the head with a skateboard for no apparent reason. Do I think the school should let him back? No, I actually don't. And in fact, I'd ask you, if you were a parent who had kids in that school, would you want that kid back in with your kids? And I would ask you this. Imagine how long it's going to take for word to get around the school, because I'll bet everybody in Gresham High School knows the name of this kid. Now, is anybody going to bring this up? Is anybody going to maybe say to the kid, hey, I saw what you did. It was wrong. Now, can you imagine the potential for trouble with a kid who's that potentially violent? I mean, the attack on this man was apparently unprovoked. Surveillance video showing a teenager hitting a man in the back of the head with a skateboard, knocking him to the ground. Apparently, there were other teens who were involved, but this is the young man who tells the police that he did the deed. Now, are those kids dangerous? Yes. Should they be back in that school right now? No. Now, police told KGW News that the group of young people, the teenagers, had been harassing Poulter. That's the name of the man that got hit. He was knocked unconscious before police got there. He was taken to Mount Hood Medical Center. They say his injuries are not life-threatening. It doesn't mean they weren't serious. It just means he isn't likely to die because of them. Well, that's a good thing, but it's not. It's kind of a thin gruel as far as I'm concerned. And what the police chief said was, while we're all still uncovering the information, the behavior demonstrated in this situation is deeply troubling. I don't even think I'd get a naysayer today to suggest that a kid like that should be back in school that soon after an incident. The incident happened Sunday evening around 5:30. The kid turned himself in Tuesday night, and by Thursday morning, the school administration thought it was appropriate to put him back in a classroom, a decision they quickly rescinded because they realized their own staff wasn't going to put up with it. So In any case, the 15-year-old boy and his parents were at the police station Tuesday evening. I would imagine that if he went to them and said, hey, or and maybe even mom and dad saw the video and saw the still images from it and said, hey, that's my kid, and probably had a conversation. And they said, it's better to turn yourself in than is it for you to wait until the police show up on your doorstep. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I'd love to take an ace here. Who thinks that kid should be back in school? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you want a great conspiracy theory on what we have always called Conspiracy Theory Thursday, imagine this. If you have federal employees who are represented by a union, and if you say, well, but the employees are paying for that union official. Oh, perish the thought. You and I are paying for that. And I thought we'd talk about it with Maxford Nelson, who's Director of Labor Policy at the Freedom Foundation. Hey, Max, welcome back to the program.
Well, my pleasure, Lars. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to do it. There's a survey as well from George Washington University about what Americans view their federal government and whether or not it's effective. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, would you mind letting them know exactly what happens when union members want to be represented, but they don't want to pay the cost of the people who do the representation, so we end up with the bill? How does that happen?
Well, it's pretty crazy, Lars, and it comes from a legal practice that officially called the official time, quote unquote. I think a much better term is taxpayer-funded union time. That's the term that President Trump gave the practice in his first term in office, and it's entirely spot on. The federal bureaucracy is massive, right? It employs millions of people, millions of public employees. A large number of those are represented by labor organizations, labor unions. And under the law that allowed and created the framework for unionization and collective bargaining in the federal workforce back in the 1970s, union officials, who are also federal employees themselves, hired to do, you know, civil service jobs, those union officials can essentially engage in union work during their federal workday while continuing to receive their regular taxpayer-funded salary and benefits. So on the one hand, unions, of course, are charging members' dues for the representation that they provide. And on the other hand, they're essentially double-dipping and asking taxpayers to foot the bill for the representational work that they do on behalf of their members. So they've got it played both ways here. And it's a fairly opaque practice, and it's one that's been controversial since its inception. But, you know, it's really a great example of, I think, why so many people don't feel that the government is working for them. And in this case, it's literally an example of the government working for an entirely different private organization.
And by the way, I'm talking to Maxford Nelson from the Freedom Foundation. Max, this isn't an example of, say, an employee who spends most of his day on doing a job for the American people because that's who's paying his paycheck or her paycheck. This is somebody who, in many cases or all cases, works full time on union activities and doesn't do a lick of work for the taxpayers. Is that fair to say?
Well, it varies. I mean, it spans the spectrum. And in some cases, you may have federal employees who are only on part time, official time. Depends on what terms they've negotiated with the federal agency that employs them. But I will say it is very, very common, and certainly unions' preference for their officers to be on full-time official time, full release, where their workday, although it's entirely paid for by taxpayers, is entirely spent on union business. In many cases, federal agencies have even given free, you know, no-cost office space to the union to have in federal facilities. Again, that is being underwritten by taxpayers. And in many cases, when these federal bureaucrats are on quote unquote official time, there's no accountability. There's no transparency into what they're doing. There's no accounting for that to make sure that it's actually being used even on workplace representation matters. And there have been scandals that pop up over the years where, as you might imagine, official time isn't even being spent on union work. It's just personal time for the employees to go do whatever it is that they want to
so
do.
So it's like they what the unions used to call a no-show job, you know, where they'd say, I'm going to put my nephew on the payroll. What's he going to do? Well, he might show up now and then, usually on payday. But most of the time, you don't have to worry about it. Just make sure his paycheck gets to him. And it's a no-show job, right?
Correct. In many cases, that can certainly happen. And, you know, this became particularly apparent during the first Trump's first term, the Trump administration. The president issued an executive order that dramatically limited official time. Now, he can't rewrite the congressional statute that allows the practice in theory, but he put some sidebars in place to prevent and minimize excessive use of official time. And one of the things that was included in that executive order was an end to this practice of 100% official time for a federal employee. So in other words, if you're a federal worker, even if you're a union official, you had to be spending at least some of your time during the day working on the job for which you were hired. And some of these union officials, again, who are also federal employees, it had been so long since they'd actually done the job for which they were hired that they had to go out and get requalified on the firing range or re-up their medical certificates because they'd let all these things lapse. They didn't need them. They weren't working for the taxpayers or for the VA or for whatever the federal job was. And so hundreds of these folks had to actually go back and get requalified to do the job for which they were hired.
And by the way, Max, you may not see this as a partisan issue, but I do. And here's why. With rare exceptions, almost all union political donations go to Democrats. So the more money that the union can avoid paying to pay people to do union work, the more money they have to make political donations with, and those donations go almost exclusively to Democrats. Did I get any of that wrong?
No, as a factual matter, you're spot on. And the unions themselves have made this a partisan issue. I mean, there's no secret about which side they're on. It's very, very clear. And so official time, the pendulum tends to swing between presidential administrations. As I mentioned, the Trump administration tried to crack down on it. The Biden administration has gone in the absolute opposite direction, is trying to increase the number of unionized federal employees, has removed all of the Trump-era limits on official time use, has actually boasted about how it's allowing more official time. As we're boosting, essentially, the amount of official time that federal workers are using, the Biden administration's Office of Personnel Management has been actively working to obscure the visibility, the public visibility, into how much time is being used. OPM used to have a website that housed a series of historic reports that the agency had published about every year or two, documenting or attempting to document anyway official time use across the government. Well, that website is now gone. OPM has not produced any new estimates of official time use since the last Trump administration report. And it's gotten to the point where congressional investigators are paying attention, and thankfully there's even been legislation introduced recently by Senator Joni Ernst and Representative Scott Franklin from Florida that would require each individual federal agency to track and annually report on the amount of official time that their workers are engaged in. It's a start. It's not. It doesn't fix the problem. But it's heartening to see more attention being paid to the issue, although it's very disheartening to see just how far the pendulum has swung in the union's direction under this.
Absolutely right. That's Maxford Nelson from the Freedom Foundation. And by the way, that survey at George Washington University done in February, it shows nearly 2 in 3 Americans believe the federal government is totally ineffective at getting things done. And by an even larger margin, they believe the government mostly makes decisions for political reasons rather than in the public interest. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
He's the best. investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. I'd love to get your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS, but I want to tell you about something brand new out there, and usually new these days means it's something strange and hard to understand. It's called money dysmorphia. I kid you not. I mean, you've heard about gender dysmorphia, and that usually consists of somebody was born a boy and now thinks he's a girl, somebody who's a girl and thinks they're a boy, or somebody who's born a boy or a girl and now they identify as neither one. They don't think they're boy. They don't think they're girl. They don't think they're male or female. They call themselves all kinds of different terms, and they insist on different pronouns. But this is something brand new. Let me get into the details in a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. But here's the way they describe it. There are people who suffer from money dysmorphia. I don't know, maybe some of us do as well. They say that social media has had a negative effect on people's self-esteem. There's a new term, money dysmorphia, that aims to describe the distorted view of one's finances that nearly one-third, 29% of Americans now say they are suffering from money dysmorphia. And apparently, they compare their own financial situation to others, say people they see on social media, and they feel inadequate. Now, I think this is just goofy. I mean, all of us have looked at a nice car or a nice house or somebody who's wearing a nice watch or has other possessions. And frankly, I don't think you should get very tied up in what other people have. What you should be concerned about more is go out, and if you want to have a nice watch or a nice car or a nice house, then go out and work hard and buy it with your own money. They say, not surprisingly, money dysmorphia is even more prevalent among younger generations, according to Credit Karma. I use Credit Karma, but I don't really have a dog in the fight there, other than using it as a way to track what my current credit rating is. Credit Karma, I don't pay them any money. They don't pay me any money. So I really don't have a dog in the fight, as I usually describe it. They say roughly 43% of Gen Z and 41% of millennials struggle with comparisons to others, and they feel that they're being left behind financially. I kid you not. I thought I'd heard it all when a few years ago I heard about something called affluenza. There was actually a young man whose parents had a lot of money, but he suffered from affluenza. That is, you come from an affluent family and you think that somehow having a lot of money changes who you are. Well, in some cases it can. You should probably fight that as much as you can. Say, it shouldn't matter how much money you have in your pocket. Shouldn't matter how much money you have in your bank account. You are either a good person or a bad person, but certainly the money shouldn't change you. Would I admit that sometimes it does change people? Absolutely, I would. But imagine when you say, well, I've been watching social media and everybody's driving Lamborghinis and everybody's wearing Rolex watches and everybody's going off on crazy vacations to wonderful places around the world, and I'm not. Well, my advice to you would be stop whining and work harder. On that note, let's go to Lisa. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I take it you wanted to say something about Joe Biden.
I do. And I know Newsmax or whatever, and you different stations make comments about his gaffe. And I'm very curious why nobody uses the gaffe he had about having the best voter fraud ever. I actually have that on my phone. I think you should use it every time you start your show.
You think I should? Well, I've heard the soundbite, and you know, it's almost as though, Lisa, we've been normed to the idea that we have a president who's so demented. He is so mentally incapacitated, and that's a sad thing when you see it happen in a member of your family. But when it's happening to somebody who's making critical decisions for the United States and the rest of the world, it's scary. But he says so many crazy things every single day. Did you hear the one yesterday where Joe Biden was giving a speech and he said, vote for me, I'm in the 20th century. And I thought, he can't really have... But he actually did. It's not an AI creation.
I saw that, and you know, it's embarrassing as an American in the United States to have him as our president. But this is a gaffe that he made when he first became president. So this was, you know, 2-3 years ago he made this gaffe, and I just don't understand why news stations, they should be playing that every single day. Because he, you know, when you have dementia, I'm a nurse, and when you have dementia, you go back to tell the truth. You're actually relaying the truth. And it's amazing the things that people do when they have dementia. They're actually telling the truth about their life. And I think when he gaffed it that it was the best voter fraud, he was telling the truth.
I think you're absolutely right. Lisa, thanks for the call. Let's go to Todd. Hey, Todd, you heard me talking about money dysmorphia. Do you think you have it figured out?
Well, for one thing, thanks for taking the call. I've been a listener for a couple of years, but we've already seen all the stories where the influencers are faking it and making all these videos while they're standing in a alleyway, you know, with a poster behind them with something and a green screen. So how well are people going to believe influencers, for one thing? And then just the definition of money dysmorphia, isn't that a fancy word for envy?
Yes. Yes, I think it is. And actually, there's something you can... But have you ever seen the movie? It was a Will Smith movie called The Pursuit of Happiness, spelled H-A-P-P-I.
Yes, I have, yes.
Isn't that... And you know, I've talked to the man, Chris Gardner, that Will Smith was portraying in real life. And I've asked him about that, and he said, oh yeah, that really happened. I mean, you know, the movie took a few liberties with this man's story, but he looked at a guy pulling up, I think it was in a Ferrari in downtown San Francisco, and he walked up to the guy, said, what kind of job do you have to do that? And he said, you have to be a stockbroker. And then Chris Gardner, the real life character played by Will Smith, but Chris Gardner decided to go and do exactly that, and he did. And he became a multimillionaire. I think he's still a motivational speaker, but he just worked hard. He worked harder than anybody else. He had tougher circumstances than most of us have had growing up. I mean, I had a forest ranger for a dad, and I grew up in the woods for most of the time, so I wasn't going to some big fancy high school. But Chris Gardner just decided, whatever it is I need to do, I'm going to go out and I'm going to do those things. And he's quite a guy to talk to, because he is pretty motivational. But instead of saying, well, if I want a car like that, what kind of job do I have to do? What do I have to learn? And how do I make that happen? These people are just sitting back, as you said, and just engaging in rank envy of other people instead of figuring out how they can duplicate or even do better than the success of the people they see. And that's sad.
Well, and most people want to just have anything handed to them, too, and anything that's going to give me for free, I know if I worked a little hard for, I could get something much better.
Well, imagine this, that Chris Gardner guy I mentioned, he spent part of the time he was working as an intern at a major stock brokerage, knowing there would be one intern picked, I think, out of 400. And he was the guy who got picked because he worked harder than anybody else. But he would sleep at night in a BART station bathroom. He would take his clothes to the, you know, the little cleaners, and he would get a nice pressed shirt, and he'd show up at work, and he worked harder than everybody else in that room, including a lot of young men and women who had gone to college and had all the advantages. He didn't have any of it. He just worked harder than everybody else, and that's what millennials and Gen Z should do, too. Todd, thanks for the call. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. No need to adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, it's becoming kind of maddening for me that Joe Biden and all of his other surrogates, like Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg, run around the country and sometimes run around Washington, D.C., and say, oh, no, don't believe your lying eyes. Crime is down in America under Joe Biden. It's safe. As Pete Buttigieg, the transpose secretary, who doesn't exactly do an admirable job on transportation. So he's out telling stories about how Washington, D.C. is a safe place to be because I can walk my dog to the White House. Well, He has full-time security detail, and that might make a little bit of a difference. But I thought I'd put it to our friend Dr. Curry Myers, who's a criminologist, former sheriff, and former state trooper. Dr. Myers, welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you, sir. Is violent crime actually down, as the White House and the mayor of New York City would like to tell us?
Not even close. The big problem is we can't trust data anymore. It seems like the last 3.5 years, we're trying to be fed a new norm when it comes to, you mentioned transportation, you mentioned economy before, the world of academia. Everything is about new norms and trying to establish new norms. And criminal justice public policy is the same. In fact, most people wouldn't realize that because the data that comes into the federal government via the Federal Bureau of Investigation is spurious. It's not correct. It's not up to date. It hasn't been up to date in the last 4 years. Anywhere from 35 to 40% of police agencies in America do not contribute 1% of any of the crime data. In fact, places like Florida have only provided 8% of the crime data, Pennsylvania 9%, New York State 24%, Maryland 38%, California not even half, Illinois and New Jersey a little bit more than half. If you look at big departments, NYPD has provided zero information, LAPD zero, Phoenix zero, San Francisco zero, Miami zero, New Orleans zero, Pittsburgh, you could go on and on and on. Well, if we're not seeing the correct information on crime data, there's no way in the world you can use that information to say anything about where crime is standing. And in fact, the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is also put out by the Department of Justice, indicated last year that they that there was a 44% increase in violent crime. And that doesn't take into account key assumptions that I've talked about now for a long time. Some of those key assumptions are 44% increase in police officer retirements, which could affect crime because we about 20% of those are not coming through the pipeline. So we're down 20% nationwide in police officers. That's going to affect crime. We have an open border policy in many cases where crime is not being detected. So that's going to affect crime. And we've had decriminalization on crime, which means we've actually no longer have police responding to crimes that used to be against the law. And in many ways, as somebody who used to work the street, it wasn't uncommon for a police officer to come to an initial crime and find other violations of crime, sometimes very, very serious. So this gets back to more of a societal issue. And I just released on my Substack today about the okaphobia that's going on in our country, which is this abnormal fear or hatred of one's own home and culture. And it seems to me that everything that the left is doing now is about not representing true American values and principles, and we're trying to tear those down.
Well, I guess I was thinking about it when you were a sheriff. I mean, if you'd said, hey, I'll make sure we get the shoplifting numbers down, and you just tell your officers, stop arresting people for shoplifting and don't take reports of shoplifting, and pretty soon the local stores will find out, yeah, we called the sheriff and he won't even take the report of the crime, so the crime just disappears from the stats. How much of this is by design, Dr. Myers?
I used to think this was an unintended consequences. I no longer, and for the last couple of years, I believe these are intended consequences because they want to keep crime. Number one, the enforcement of crime has become racial. And the enforcement of crime has become bigoted. And it's they cast the entire criminal justice system into be systematically racist and bigoted. That's the first thing and foremost. The second thing is, from a political point of view, it's not advantageous for police officers to be out arresting people because it makes cities and counties and states and the federal government look bad if crime goes up. So the weaponization, the political weaponization of law enforcement and criminal justice should never occur because it has an impact on the safety and the security of Americans. And that just cannot be tolerated.
No, it can't. I'm talking to Dr. Curry Myers, but Dr. Myers, let me point this out. You're familiar with this most recent case of this guy, Dexter Reed, in Chicago, who got shot to death?
Yes.
Okay, so here's a guy who last July showed up in Chicago at some festival, and he was carrying a gun illegally and was charged, and then he's pulled over in a traffic stop. And if you listen to most of the major media, for example, USA Today said seatbelt violation ends up with black man dead on Chicago street after cops fire 100 bullets. And they leave out Mr. Reed's prior, criminal involvement with illegally carrying a gun. They leave out the fact that when he was pulled over, he could have simply handed over his license, his registration, his proof of insurance. Instead, he started to roll up the window and then he shot one of the cops in the arm. And at that point, the cops naturally shot back. But if you leave all that out, it's just seatbelt violation leads to black man dead in Chicago. Police fire 100 rounds. And that's the way it's being portrayed to people. And they'll say, oh, my goodness, a black man can't drive down the street. And if he doesn't have his seatbelt on, he's going to get shot to death. No, if you shoot a cop, he's going to shoot back if he can. Right.
That's exactly correct, and one could make the argument that this person, if they would have been arrested and received the full force of the law, including not being allowed out on bail potentially, then he may not have even been in a position to commit these criminal actions and end up dead himself. Now, there are laws on the books that, and police, let me have probably a newsflash for people. Law enforcement does not determine what laws are going to be enforced. The states determine what kind of laws are going to be enforced, and then law enforcement goes out and enforces those laws. And when you commit a traffic infraction, if you don't do anything about it, it's called focused deterrence in anything that we do, then people are not going to pay attention to laws. And so that's the whole problem that's going on with America now is focused deterrence has become some action that should never occur, that it's unfair if you go out and enforce the laws that are actually on the books that help society. A society works better if we operate in norms and customs and values and put guardrails into place to keep bad people from doing bad things. And the best way to do that is through focused deterrence. And if law enforcement gets out of bounds of that, there's ramifications that occur all the time, and usually through the court system, in which the agencies or the officer themselves will go through the required court actions to be able to either become someone who is accused of crime and ultimately stand charged for that crime, or be exonerated.
Absolutely right. Dr. Curry Myers. Dr. Myers, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you very much. Dr. Myers is a criminologist, former sheriff, and former state trooper. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. I want to tell you this. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Well, Donald Trump threw down the gauntlet today and said, quote, it's time for crooked Joe Biden, the worst president in the history of the United States, and I to debate. I agree with Donald Trump in this case, and in most cases. Should Joe Biden take up President Trump's challenge to debate? I'd answer that one yes. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question on X, which used to be known as Twitter, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I talked about this crazy idea that was put forward by who else? A Democrat member of Congress, a freshman from Texas, Jasmine Crockett. She said, we should make up for past wrongs against black Americans by forgiving them from paying income taxes. I said, should America exempt black citizens from paying income taxes? I said no. 96% of you said no as well. Only 4% of you said yes to that crazy idea. I also want to update this. I'm going to continue to follow up on Gresham High School. In the Northwest, the schools have begun to treat crimes by kids in a way that is absolutely going to encourage more criminality. And in this case, you've got a really ugly situation where a teenager, we don't know his name, although I'd hope to find out at some point, 15 years old, he and a group of friends are harassing a 58-year-old man who's doing nothing but standing on the street corner, minding his own business. And then at one point, the 15-year-old picks up his skateboard, which is really just a big chunk of wood with wheels on it, and hits the man in the back of the head. Thankfully, he did not kill the man. Thankfully, the man is going to recover from his injuries. We're told that he has non-life-threatening injuries. That happened on Sunday. There were surveillance cameras in the area that caught video of the incident, and the police publicized the video. And on Tuesday night, the 15-year-old came into the police station, in this case in Gresham, with parents, and said, I'm the one in the video. I'm the one who hit the man in the back of the head. He was back in school this morning at Gresham High School. And the teachers at Gresham High School, I'm told because we have a great source, were told that kid is not coming back to class until we have a meeting and lay out a plan for his return to school. He came back to school this morning without any of that. And apparently, for all the best reasons in the world, the teachers pitched a fit. And they said, why is this kid back in class when we haven't even talked about what steps should be taken to make sure he does not present a danger to the other students? At that point, the school then decided to remove him from the class again. So when we reached out to Gresham High School, Gresham Schools, all they would say was, he is not in school right now. They wouldn't say anything else. They wouldn't go on the record. Nobody will answer questions. But just so you know, we did our due diligence. We reached out to Gresham High School. Now, we may get some complaints from Gresham High saying, we don't like the fact that you're talking about this. Well, tough luck, pound sand, because the schools have been doing this in both Oregon and Washington. They act as though crimes that happen within the bounds of the school are not crimes. That somehow, if you commit an assault, if you sell drugs, if there's sexual abuse of one kind or another. I told you just a week ago about a 9-year-old girl. The 9-year-old girl was raped in a school bathroom 2 years ago. We never found out about it. And why? Because the school broke Oregon law. The Oregon law said if you even suspect that a child has been abused physically or sexually or otherwise, you are absolutely required to contact police. Did the schools contact police in that case? No, they didn't. They broke the law. And what happened instead? Well, 2 years have gone by, and the girl's family, she's now 11 years old, the girl's family has filed a fairly major lawsuit. I think it's $9 million that they filed against the school district. And the school district, I would bet, will end up paying. Maybe not $9 million, but they'll end up paying. But this happens time and time and time again in the Northwest. Because, and it may be happening elsewhere, but my concern for the Radio Northwest Network is here in the Pacific Northwest. You have school administrators who, number one, believe that a child can commit a crime against another child, against a teacher, against a staff member, and it is not a crime if it happened on school property. So they do not call the police. Many of the schools in the Northwest have foolishly said, let's get rid of the school cops. And why? Because if a school cop was on campus and a rape occurred, it would be treated as a rape. Instead, the schools have been saying, we'll do the investigation. I want to tell you something. You can admire teachers for a lot of things. They have no expertise in doing criminal investigations. They have no expertise in whether or not a child is guilty or not. It's not their job. It is the job of the police and the prosecutor and the courts. And if you say, well, Lars, are you asking that 9-year-old kids who commit a rape be sent to prison? It isn't even possible. But what would happen is those 2 9-year-olds who committed the rape against that little girl, they would be in front of a judge. They and their parents would be answering to the judge, and the judge would set out a plan to try to correct their behavior. Would it always be effective? I'm not foolish enough to make that claim. But at the very least, there'd be some accountability. With the schools the way they're run right now, there is no accountability.
The Lars Larson Show.